Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Optusport Football Podcast for the season 23-24. With Mark Schwarzer absent this week, it's me, Phil Kitramalides, at the helm. With a newcomer, John McKenzie from TIFO at The Athletic joins us for the very first time on the podcast. Hello, John. Welcome to your first episode of the Optusport Football Podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I'm not used to actually podcasting at this early hour, so let's see how my brain holds up.
Okay, fingers crossed you're in good shape at this early hour. John's a newcomer, very much not a newcomer to the podcast, is Michael Bridges. Hello, Bridgie.
Good morning from a very cold England, and it's great to be back with yourself at the helm because Swartz is absolutely useless at hosting this, Phil. And I do believe that you might be a little bit dusty, and I've got to wish you all the best and congratulations, mate. Happy 40th birthday over the weekend. You are slowly catching me and Mark up.
Yeah, slowly but surely I'm getting there. Thank you very much. It was my 40th birthday on Sunday, and I was treated to two absolutely brilliant games that I watched. I watched Man City Tottenham, and then I watched Barcelona against Atletico Madrid, and they were two really, really good games. I felt very, very lucky to be blessed with a magnificent game of football to watch and enjoy on a special day. Speaking of magnificent games of football, let's start talking about Man City against Spurs, which finished 3-3 at the Etihad. Spurs continuing their really good run against Manchester City. They're fast becoming City's bogey team. The way they got something out of this game, though, was a little bit different to the way that they've done it in previous years. Obviously, perhaps against Antonio, without Antonio Conte at the helm, they would have had very little possession and tried to hit Manchester City on the break. And that is not what they did at the Etihad. They went there, they didn't change their style. And if you were to look up Ange Ball in the dictionary, maybe you'd just get the highlights of this game, because it was full Ange Ball at the Etihad, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, it was a really exciting game. Although interesting that you say we didn't get Antonio Conte ball. Actually, the first goal was very reminiscent of what we saw under Antonio Conte, because a quick break from a corner, which saw Spurs score their first chance on target, and that was the ins and outs of what we saw in the wins that they've picked up with the last few managers. So, but as you say, very much a blueprint of Ange Ball, this with lots of build up, lots of deep build up, even under intense pressure often from Manchester City, and despite that, no change in plan from the Spurs players. They retained their bravery under that pressure, moving the ball down the field. And actually, the final goal came from just one of those moments where they held onto the ball, moved it through the Manchester City pressure, and were able to get the ball into Kulusevski, who got a famous equaliser. So yeah, Ange Postecoglou, very famous for saying, "I'm not going to change the way that we play," and that was very much in operation at the weekend.
I don't think anyone expected him to change the way that they played, Bridgie, right? We knew what was going to happen, surely.
Yeah, all day long. And very, very rarely goes away from his vision, his style of play and his philosophy, because he almost sees it as defeat. He's had a very, very successful career playing this Ange Ball, this style of high pressing and the intensity levels, and he was never going to change it. And I'm delighted that he didn't. We knew he wouldn't. And you've seen the benefits. I mean, that to go toe-to-toe with Man City and get that result with the personnel that were missing as well. We've said, you know, he was coming off the back of three losses. It was very tough since that Chelsea game. So it was a huge, huge moment. And if anybody was knew they were going to be in for a tough task, it was Pep Guardiola, because Pep has complimented Ange Postecoglou in the past. They met when Ange was the manager of Yokohama Marinos in the J-League in a pre-season game. And Pep came out after and was, "Oh my God, we have just been hassled and rushed and almost ran off the field by the style of play." So he knew what was going to come. It could have been so different first half. Mind, there was a lot of chances for City that they created and squandered, especially with Haaland. He didn't expect it. But I loved the comment after the game, Phil. What I've got to say is there was Kulusevski got interviewed, and he said, "You know what it is, I got a right telling off at half time." And then Ange came on and he said, "Well, I didn't actually tell him off, but I can't use many words that I use in the dressing room. Now, I know he would have been screaming and bawling, but what Ange would have been saying, there's a difference between having a go at your players with bad language and actually saying, go out there and believe in yourselves, in the style of play, because I think they felt a little bit underdone and didn't feel like they had the quality to control that game and keep the ball and play the Ange ball. When they came out second half and Ange had give them that little lecture and basically it's like a momentum boost and good for the mindset. They came out and just showed what they are capable of doing. So it was a huge, huge result at the end of the day at the Etihad. And fair play, Kulusevski, you've just mentioned there, John, his goal at the end. I don't think it was the most glitzy and glamour of headers because it came off his shoulder, but it went in the back of the net. And yeah, fair play to Ange and Tottenham Hotspur for coming out with that result.
It does feel like this was a big result, not just because they got a point away to the champions, but also mentally for everyone to sort of buy into what's going on, coming off the back of those three defeats in really quite painful circumstances. We know what happened in the Chelsea game. We know what happened in the Wolves game where they conceded twice very late on. And the Aston Villa game, they could have scored 5 or 6 and ended up losing. So to come off the back of that run, go to the champions, go toe-to-toe with them and get something out of the game, playing the way that they did, I think mentally the team will be really reinforced, no?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think the standout for me as well was Lo Celso. Ange Postecoglou a few weeks back said your opportunities to showcase what you're available for and what I forgot he'd even been there. and he popped up and it was a tremendous, tremendous goal. So you would have been chuffed to bits with that. But tactically, John, what did you make of both teams going into this one?
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting game in terms of particularly the build-up, because in the first half Spurs were using particularly a single pivot, so they were using as we know Yves Bissouma as their single pivot, and they were really getting pressed quite aggressively by Man City, who are matching them up pretty much player for player. But in the second half they brought on Pierre-Emile Højbjerg, sat him alongside Bissouma, and it just gave them a little bit more flexibility in the build-up phase. They actually ended up with more possession in the second half than they did in the first half, and it gave them a little bit more leeway to do the stuff that they were trying to do. So yeah, again, you know, lots of swearing in the halftime team talk, but also a little bit of tactical nous in there from Ange as well.
We're talking about a Tottenham perspective, not just because Bridgie and I happen to be Spurs fans and this is a Australian podcast for an Australian audience, so there is an Australian at the helm of Tottenham, but we should talk about City as well and how frustrated is Guardiola going to be with this result, John? How frustrated is he that his team are conceding a lot of goals at the moment? They don't seem to be able to control games.
Yeah, it's a tough one because I think, you know, as an analyst, I'll often check out the underlying numbers to see, you know, the quality of the chances created. And this is another game where they've come away with dropping points, despite the fact that they've actually, Michael pointed out earlier, they generated enough chances to put this one to bed. We saw Julian Alvarez hitting the post when they were at 2-1 up. If that goes in, you know, you would feel as though City would have the quality to just carry that one through. And they've come off the back of a few results as well, where they've dropped points where, you know, in another timeline, not that far away, they pick up all 3 points and they're sitting top of the Premier League at the moment. So games against Chelsea, even the game against Arsenal, which was a very tetchy affair that ended up going Arsenal's way, that could have gone the other way not too difficultly. And I think they're in this sort of moment at the moment where they're sort of variancing badly on every available possibility. And you know, we all know that Man City, they come into the second half of seasons and they go onto those incredible tears where you just don't think they're ever going to lose a game ever again. But this season it does feel a little bit different. We've seen them lose a couple of games already, which is you know, very unlikely for them. I think across the Pep Guardiola era, they've lost between 4 and 5 games a season on average across that whole time. So already well within that sort of range at this early point in the season. So yeah, I think that there's a lot going on with City. As you've mentioned, they do look a little bit open in terms of the defence. Again, I mentioned the Chelsea game as well. Both the Chelsea game and this game, they had the chance to just hold out for 3 points going into the last 10 minutes of the game, and they've not managed to do that. And you know, they can beat themselves up and say, well, you know, we're pretty low possibility of losing those games, but you still have to make those defensive mistakes to allow opponents back in, and Pep Guardiola will be lying awake at night thinking about that. That's the sort of manager he is. He lies awake at night worrying about, you know, his rest defence and teams hitting them on the counter. So yeah, it's setting this season up to be a real banger of a title challenge. So I think in that respect, from the neutral's point of view and from the point of view of fans who are teams where they are challenging for the title, it makes for a really fun season going into the second half of it. But I think that Pep will probably feel a little bit aggrieved to be in such a, maybe, well, I mean, not even in the top two at this point of the season.
And I've got to pull my hands up and say apologies to Manchester City listeners and Jack Grealish lovers. I did have a go at him a few weeks ago, just, you know, Doku was giving Manchester City a whole new lease of life. He looks fantastic going forward. And, he hit the crossbar on the post and one opportunity. And he unfortunately got injured. And the man that I said, you know, I haven't enjoyed watching him of late for Manchester City, he came up with the goods. He got himself a goal. And I think that's exactly what Jack needed. You know, the celebration when he scored, he all his teammates ran off to one side. And then Jack decided, you know what it is? I owe this moment to Haaland. He ran back over to celebrate with Haaland. Fair play to him. It's good to see him back on the score sheet. I am a big fan of Jack. I like him, but I just see the way that he's gone from Aston Villa style of play, and he's learnt a new style under Pep Guardiola. It's taken him into a new stratosphere, I think, tactically, and understanding the game more. But I just haven't seen the Jack Grealish creating chances and scoring enough goals that I wanted to see. But there you go. Humble pie eaten by Mr. Bridges for all you City and Jack Grealish lovers. Because I got a bit of stick fill on Twitter.
I'm not surprised. Not for the first time, also, Bridgie. Speaking of Jack Grealish, he could have had another goal, because there was a little bit of controversy at the end of this game when Erling Haaland had the ball, seemingly got fouled in the middle of the park, shrugged off the challenge and played Jack Grealish through on goal. And the referee looked like he'd played the advantage and then blew the whistle. It's a really, really strange sequence. Obviously, Manchester City and Erling Haaland in particular, absolutely furious at what happened. I mean, the referee's just made a mistake here. He's made a big mistake, isn't it? There's nothing else. There's no other explanation.
Phil, I've got to say, it's a disgrace. I thought he had an unbelievable match. I can't. What was the name of the referee? I should have known this because I was shouting him.
Simon Hooper.
Simon Hooper, thank you. I was calling him a lot worse on the TV screen, even though it was against Tottenham Hotspur, Phil. It was not a good decision because you've initially gone to see him blow the whistle for the foul. He hasn't. He's played on. And the ball over the top from Haaland. I don't know how Haaland's actually got up from a tackle and being able to play that pass, in all honesty, because
because he's just a cyborg, Bridgie. Cyborg. We know that.
I'm going to have to look back at it because there's something amiss how he's managed to do it. And Jack is in on goal and he's actually got 2 or 3 yards the time in the run. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, here we go. It's a counter-attack goal in the last minute and he blew the whistle. So I was really happy. But when you look back at it, it's disgusting that was allowed to happen. And it takes a lot to get Haaland. You know, I played with Alfie's dad at Leeds, and he was the most relaxed guy in the world. The only time I ever saw anything happen was between him and Roy Keane. That obviously escalated very, very quickly over seasons. It takes a lot to get them angry, and the way Haaland reacted, you can tell he was absolutely fuming because he knows it was the wrong decision. Then the one where Pep Guardiola stands next to the fourth official and he's trying to get an explanation, the fourth official's blatantly looking at anywhere else he can because he knows it's the wrong decision. That just tells it for me. So yeah, Tottenham got away with one there, and very, very lucky. It was a shocking decision. There's nothing you do about it.
The only explanation I could come up with is that was maybe there was quite a few players in between the referee and Grealish, and he didn't realise that he was necessarily through in on goal. But
a very Spursy answer there from Phil.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's definitely the wrong decision. Definitely the wrong decision. But yeah, we don't like to talk about referees too much on the podcast, but obviously we had to mention it because it was a big, big moment in the game. All right, that was a really quite epic game, and I think we've had quite a few of those in the Premier League this season, and indeed this weekend, because there were some really terrific matches, loads of goals, loads of drama, loads of entertainment, and it's all kind of bringing it all together nicely, shall we say, in terms of the top four, in terms of the title race as well. If you look at the table, 6 points separating the top five, Arsenal 2 points clear of Liverpool, who have got City a further point back, and Aston Villa in fourth as well, ahead of Spurs, who are in fifth, so 6 points separating those five teams. It is it's working up very nicely to the title race. John, what are your feelings at this point after 14 match days? Who's in pole position for the title? Is it as open as it looks? Is there anyone else who's going to be getting involved?
This is not a very analytical answer, but I've got a funny feeling that City aren't going to win the league this season. Now, I've already mentioned,
forget all your metrics, forget all the stats. Funny yeah. feelings is what we like. Yes,
funny good. Feeling. Yeah, we've already said that. I mean, I've already said that. Many times in the past we've been made to look silly by thinking that Man City are off the top of the table, therefore they're not going to win the league. I guess the case in point was last season, where it looked as though Arsenal, for all intents and purposes, were going to win the league. So yeah, I'm fully aware of the fact that what will happen in the second half of the season is that Pep will find his big solution, as he always does, and that will carry them through to a win. But this season it just feels as though there are strong contenders in the league. Despite the fact that we've spent a lot of time, I think, talking about how weak the bottom three are potentially, I feel as though above that, anyone can take points off anyone, and that will spread the points around. It's a difficult league to win this season, and we have those contenders in Liverpool and Arsenal from very different directions. Liverpool with an overpowered attack and maybe defensively a little bit shaky, and then on the other hand, we've got Arsenal, who don't look like they're ever going to concede a goal, even if they don't ever look like they're going to score a goal either at the other end. So it's really setting up to be quite a fun title run as we're going in. Is it going to be attack that's going to win the day? Is it going to be defence that's going to be win the day? Or is it going to be Man City sort of okay attacking, okay defending, winning the day? So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how it unfolds.
John, can I just ask you about Aston Villa? Because in the pre-season podcast we did, I was very excited to see Villa under Unai Emery. I tipped them to maybe be challenging for top four. I don't know, are they exceeding your expectations? Did you think that they'd be there or thereabouts? Obviously, their away form is considerably worse than their home form. But what are your feelings on Villa at the moment?
Yeah, Villa are an interesting team. I think Villa are a team where we talk about game state a lot. And what I mean by game state is that you know the situation that you're in during a game that can impact the way that teams are playing. So, for example, if you're up in games or down in games, it can change the way that you approach those games. And Villa seem to be very much a game state team, whereby if you look at, I think, four of the away losses that they've had, they've conceded goals in the first 6 minutes of those games, and they've just not been able to get back into them, really. And I think that's what we're seeing from Villa, is that if they get ahead in games, they can often carry them through and look really comfortable, but if they go behind, then that's when the problems are going to arise. So I think, you know, in terms of what Unai Emery's achieved, it's just an amazing turnaround in form. He's got them looking so dangerous, but I think that in terms of the actual title challenge, I think they're probably not going to be quite consistent enough in order to stay in that race. I think that the big question for them is, can they get top four? And you know, there's a real possibility that they could achieve Champions League football.
Bridgie, how's your tip for the title Brighton doing?
Thank you, Phil. That's kind of fallen by the wayside, hasn't it? They're only 11 points off top. That is doable, mate. They could have an unbelievable surge. I think that is gone. I got very, very excited when we saw them play against Manchester United and turn it on, because I didn't realise how poor Manchester United were going to be this season. So I think it was kind of it was over excited. But I still enjoy watching the way they play. They've got the European challenge on their hands as well, which is a new challenge for them, as all teams that have found out this season, where keeping your numbers and your players fit and ready for them games. Newcastle have struggled with that as well, with the extra travel and the extra game load. So, I take it back, Phil. They're not in. But what I will agree with John, it's going to be so exciting to see this season unfold, because there is so many teams in the mix, and I'm absolutely delighted nobody's running away with it. It's making it so exciting from, I would say, 12th up over towards the top half of the table. It's going to be magnificent. And like John was saying, anybody can beat anybody in this moment. And I feel for the teams that are now in the bottom three, that have, you know, the teams that have come up, because the gap is getting so much bigger. But what I am excited that most of them teams that are in and around that mix at the top, your Arsenal, your Liverpool, City, Villa, Tottenham, Newcastle, the top six, I would say, are playing so attacking and exciting football. Manchester United, you can count out, they've been so lucky. I couldn't even believe that they were in seventh after seeing, you know, they've got some, McTominay came on and saved them late on in the game against Brentford. But, you know, Brighton have been enjoyable to watch as well. So, yeah, it's very, very exciting. And like you say, as long as the football's, you're going to get goals. That's one thing we will be guaranteed in the Premier League.
It feels like the Prem needed a season like this, really, really open, not just City running away with it. And at the moment, it is very, very exciting. I mean, City could still run away with it. You know, we've seen them, and John made allusions to their second half performances in seasons. But yeah, let's see. You guys have both mentioned the bottom three. We should say that at the time of recording, there are really, really strong reports that Paul Heckingbottom's going to be sacked at Sheffield United. Perhaps not a surprise. They've got the worst attacking record, the worst defensive record. They just lost 5-0 to the team that was previously bottom of the table, and now they are currently bottom of the table. So if this is to happen before the Blades take on Liverpool in midweek, it wouldn't be a really big shock, would it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mentioned it last week on the podcast, Phil, that if there were anybody, you know, I think we had five sackings at this point last season, and I was saying that they'd been given a lot more time due to what Cooper had done with Nottingham Forest. Whereas Leeds United, unfortunately, went through the managerial roundabout and it didn't help them. So there was a little bit of face shown. And if this is the case, I said Heckingbottom, because the way they've been conceding goals. And obviously, when you're playing a team that is it's a six-pointer, a relegation rival, and you get beat 5-0. And they just looked absolutely shot to bits. Heckie's my mate. He's had a good stint at Sheffield for the job that he's done. But unfortunately, I do feel that is the right time, because I've noticed that it's almost like the players have run out of ideas. And I just see him and Stuart McCall on the sideline kind of scratching their heads. They need a lift and they need it from somewhere. And I think it's inevitable, sadly. But yeah, there you go. That is the ruthlessness of being a manager.
But yeah, there has been time given, I think, as you mentioned, to managers this season, because I live and work in Spain and cover Spanish football extensively. And I was looking at this and saying, Paul Heckingbottom's going to be the first manager to be sacked this season. We've already had about 10 managerial sackings in Spain this season. So yeah, I think people in the Prem with a little bit more patience. Let's go back and discuss matters at the towards the top of the table, because Newcastle United beating Manchester United by a goal to nil. We'll talk about that in just a moment. We want to play you a clip, though, from Paul Scholes on Optus Sports live coverage of the game, raising question marks about Manchester United's commitment and, in particular, Marcus Rashford's input. It's quite damning. Here's what he had to say.
Right then, Paul, which adjectives are you choosing to describe that Manchester United performance?
Rubbish. They're a poor football team at this minute, aren't they? Too many lazy players on the football team. You can't get away with that. Marcus Rashford and Garnacho, they don't even run back, they walk back. And you can see the joy that Newcastle are getting down both sides. You feel a little bit sorry for fullbacks. What are they supposed to do? They're two against one every time, and nobody's telling these players. These are young players. Marcus Rashford's attitude, I thought, was shocking. And when he gets taken off, he starts throwing his gloves. What is he surprised about? I don't get it. I don't understand what is he thinking he should still be on the pitch for? He was causing the team more harm than good. Now, Marcus last year was brilliant, and he's got ability, there's no doubt about that. But when you decide to walk back like he is doing, and he comes off and behaves like that, I don't think it's good for the team. And he's one of the most experienced players now. He's a player that these players are looking up to. Mane's looking up to him. Garnacho's looking up to him.
So Paul Scholes there speaking about Manchester United, but in particular about Marcus Rashford. And what he's saying there, John, he's not necessarily having a go at him for his lack of attacking output, and his numbers are way, way down on what they were last season. But it's his defensive or lack of defensive work in the team which he feels is hurting Man United.
Yeah, well, all due respect to Paul Scholes, I actually feel as though the problem with Marcus Rashford in this game was that he was expected to do too much out of possession. We've seen from Erik ten Hag across his time at Manchester United, he wants to play quite an intense form of out of possession football, where they actually win the ball high up the field. They're very aggressive, and there's lots of running to be done by, including the wide forwards. And I think, you know, that has resulted in high turnovers and when you're a team like Manchester United, the players that they have, you want to try and get into these sort of transitional moments where you're able to attack space at speed. And that seems to be the sort of approach that Erik ten Hag has lent into. Part and parcel of that is that you have to get all of your players running about helping from the front. And what we saw so much from that game against Newcastle was periods where Marcus Rashford was in the fullback area having to help out defensively. And I think the problem there is that, you know, if you do get the ball back and you're able to get it forward, Rashford has a huge amount of space to cover in order to get near the goal to score those really dangerous chances that he generates through just ball progression himself. So I can understand why a Manchester United fan in Paul Scholes would be focusing on a lack of effort, but I actually think that a lot of this does come down to the play style that they're putting in place. Part of the problem then being that because Manchester United have to be so aggressive defensively with their wide forwards, that actually that you don't give your wide forwards enough chance to actually do the attacking parts that you know is their primary role.
I've got to say, I think it was even highlighted more so, John, when you've got Almiron and Anthony Gordon,
yeah,
who are able to do it and have been doing it all season under Eddie Howe, where they've been helping out the defenders, the fullbacks. I mean, this time it was Livramento and Trippier. They've gone and doubled up when they've needed to, but as soon as Newcastle have got the ball, they've gone and gone in high and wide positions, and then they've drifted inside when Livramento or Trippier has gone to join in. They were just full of energy. And I remember speaking to Craig Bellamy, the Burnley assistant, after Burnley played Newcastle United, and what he was saying after the game, he said the high-intensity runs that we've just seen on the board from Newcastle United's players, as opposed to ours, we are nowhere near the level that they are at. And this was before, obviously, the injuries started kicking in. But again, you could see it in this game. And what the difference is, I see the players at Newcastle United that have an understanding of the tactics and the game mentality that they are told to go and play. They understand it and they want to go and work for the manager. And I see a Manchester United that players are scratching their heads, playing in different positions, not understanding their roles and responsibilities, and not giving a crap about what the manager's saying. Because there was an incident where Martial looked over at the bench. Ten Hag's having a go at him. Both their arms are up in the air going like, what am I meant to be doing? And then when I saw Martial basically brush the manager off and give him like a flick away, as much as say, foof, what, like, you know, stuff you. That is absolutely horrendous. And I just feel that Man United is toxic. And I think they've got to do something quickly, because if you think there was the incident with Maguire, there was the incident with Sancho, and now ex-players like Scholesy and Roy Keane are coming out and individually naming and shaming some of the players that was probably the best player last season and seasons before with the goals that he scored. Something's happened and they are mentally drained, because I know Rashford is very close with Sancho and they feel like there's been injustice done behind the scenes here. So I think it's only going to get worse for Man United.
And yet, coming into this game, Man United were one of the form teams in the Premier League. They'd won five of the last six games in the Premier League. It's very, very strange.
It's crazy, Phil, because they've been playing pretty bang average football, but they've got results from it. And it was a shock to see where they were. But when you dissect it and you have a look at it, the actual game plan, and the fans will tell you, I've watched them five times this season, it's been absolutely toilet to watch. And somehow they've managed to get away to play it. They've been played off the park at times. And you just look, how have they managed to get away with that? And it's basically just what you're doing. You're just sandpapering over the cracks that are appearing. And he's tarnished it very well. At some point, this is going to implode. And I feel like this game has highlighted where Man United are at.
Do the underlying metrics, John, show that Manchester United have been absolutely toilet?
Yes, they do. I mean, in terms of their attacking and defensive numbers, they are not good. They're very much mid-table. There is a metric out there called expected points, which takes a lot of the underlying numbers and tries to work out the likelihood of you picking up a certain amount of points in each game. And according to that metric, and most models that I've seen, Manchester United are in the bottom half of the table. So yeah, there's been a few situations where they've picked up, you know, single goal wins against teams like Luton and Burnley. We've already mentioned the Brentford result, where a couple of a brace from McTominay in injury time sort of turned that one around as well. And I think that, you know, they've been dicing with death, I think, a lot of the time in games against teams towards the bottom half of the table. And I think they've got a run now where they've got some tough fixtures, and we're going to start seeing those poor performances actually translate into poor results from here on in.
You mentioned their upcoming fixtures. They've got an interesting one, a really interesting one in midweek. There is a full round of Premier League matches, by the way, which you lucky people on Optusport can watch in midweek. It's Manchester United against Chelsea, which is a fantastic looking fixture. And they've also got to go to Liverpool before Christmas as well. So there are some tough games coming up for Manchester United. They're 5 points off a Champions League spot, by the way, at the moment. And speaking of the Champions League, they've got to play Bayern Munich as well in a few days' time. So it doesn't get any easier,
Phil,
for Erik Ten Hag's men.
You've just mentioned a team that they've got to play coming up with Christmas, Liverpool. I have to say, the result, the 4-3 win over Fulham, the way that they managed to do it, absolutely. The chances they created, I mean, when you score three at Anfield, you think you're going to win. So Fulham will be coming away thinking, what's going on? But, you know, 25-plus chances that Liverpool created, the way they did it, the resolve they showed, I've got to say, man, what a performance it was. Even though it was close, I mean, it's entertaining to watch for the neutral anyway, but I have to say, Liverpool, they look like they're in mean machine mode. I had to give them a shout out because it's, you know, we do, there's a lot of Liverpool fans in Australia. I've given Klopp a bit of stick in the past for his sideline antics, but my word, he's got this team ticking. And yes, they conceded, but they found a way, and Trent Alexander-Arnold yet again, absolutely superb.
You know, the last team to win a league game at Anfield?
Leeds United, isn't it?
Yes, it was Somerville's, Somerville's goal late at Anfield. I was there. I got out early before I got chinned because I was celebrating.
But that was 14 months ago. Yeah, they've been really, really strong at home this season. They've been scoring loads of goals as well at Anfield. And yeah, mean machine mode is how Bridges described them. They do look... There is something ominous about them, Liverpool, and the fact that not... Okay, people are talking about them, but maybe not as much as they should be, John. I don't know, in terms of a title run.
Yeah, I mentioned it before. It's sort of a case of one of the most exciting attacks in world football, matched with questions about them defensively. And I think in the past, look, we're coming out of an era of Manchester City dominance where you have to be good at everything in order to challenge them. And I think that's why this season is so interesting, because if Man City do drop off, then maybe we're back into the realms of possibility where you can win the league by having a really overpowered attack and maybe not as good a defence. Or, as we've been talking with Arsenal, like a really strong defence and maybe not an overpowered attack. So I think that's another reason why the City sort of slight decline might make this a really fun season, because I think we've been Man City pilled recently into thinking that in order to win the Premier League, you have to be perfect at everything. And we're starting to see teams now just really find their upside in one area, and that being enough to carry them towards the top of the table.
And Liverpool have got three very easy games to come. Sheffield United, Crystal Palace and Man United. So there's 9 points on the board just before Christmas. Nice and easy.
yes, one for the Liverpool fans listening, of whom there are many, I'm sure. As we mentioned, there is a full round of Premier League fixtures coming up in midweek, including Arsenal visiting Luton, Liverpool visiting Sheffield United, Manchester United against Chelsea, Spurs against West Ham and Aston Villa hosting a Manchester City side who are without Rodri, who is suspended. So some really, really interesting and tasty and exciting looking fixtures coming up in midweek. All right, let's move on and head to Spain and discuss what's going on in La Liga, the big game of the weekend. By the way, I don't know if you guys are aware, but there's a bit of a marketing drive from La Liga. We are now supposed to refer to Barcelona against Atletico Madrid as El Super Duelo, the Super Duel, a bit like El Clasico, but now it's called El Super Duelo. So I'm on a one-man push to try and make sure everybody calls it this. I doubt it's going to happen, but I'll do my best. Anyway, Barcelona win the Super Duelo by 1-0 against Atleti, and it had to be João Félix to score the goal, the man who is on loan from Atletico Madrid, the man who in the summer desperately professed his desire to leave Atletico Madrid and join Barcelona. And he scored. It was a really nice goal as well. And a pretty vigorous celebration as well, standing on the hoarding and looking at the crowd. He didn't kiss the badge, but he wasn't far off. He's still on loan from Atleti as well. But he never really quite worked out for him at Atletico Madrid. And I've got a feeling that... yeah, we might not see him again.
Phil, do you blame him for celebrating, really, because of the way that Simeone has treated him? I mean, if any Atletico fan begrudges that, because I'm a big fan of his.
They do, Bridgie. Let me tell you. They do, yes.
Well, he's got to go back with a crash helmet on and he's got to go there. But I feel the way that he was trepped with Simeone, he had a go at Chelsea, didn't quite work out for him. And to do that against his old club, it was inevitable. I think, I scored when I left Sunderland, I scored for Leeds United against Sunderland. When I left Leeds, I scored for Carlisle against my old team. It just seems that something seems to happen, you know. And for him to do that, I was chuffed a bit. And I think the goal itself was absolutely magnificent, the dink, because, you know, All Black is a world-class goalkeeper. And the way that he had the endeavour to get there, the little dink. And it's moments like that when you score this. I think the occasion got to him. And when he got on the hoardings, I just thought, yeah, fair play to you. And to get the winning goal, I thought it was justification for him personally, because of the way that he'd been trepped by Simeone. Not the fans. I'd let it go because I think they're going to hate him now. But I think they still had a lot of fondness for him because of what he's done for them.
You mentioned the goal he scored, and it is actually a very interesting. The finish is fantastic, but yeah, in order to get to the ball, he has to get to the ball first and beat Nahuel Molina in an individual duel. And those were the kind of things that he was not doing at Atletico Madrid, and he was super extra motivated for this game. And it was a terrific goal, John.
Yeah, and a touch of the Jude Bellinghams about his celebration as well, wasn't it, I think. But yeah, really interesting watching Barcelona evolve under Xavi, because we've just done a podcast at Tifo looking at the three seasons that Xavi's been at Barcelona, and each season has been very different from a tactical point of view. And this season hasn't gone as swimmingly as he might have liked so far. So I think that, you know, everyone was touting Atletico as being the form team who are actually going to pull off of the title challenge. This is a really important result, I think, from that point of view for Barcelona to show that even though they've drifted off the top of the table, and it's looking more like Girona who are going to be challenging Real Madrid at the top of the table, when it comes to the crunch, Barcelona can still pull out these kind of results as well.
Well, can I just say, used to, it's time to shine. Because the team you've just mentioned there, Giron, I do believe that, John, you did an article or a tactical analysis on them. And Phil has talked them up for a long, long time on this podcast and was basically saying, watch out. These are the real deal.
The hashtag is always watch Girona. Always watch Girona, because they provide unbelievable entertainment. And this season they did it again. This weekend, rather, they did it again. I don't know if you were doing your homework, Bridgie. You probably didn't watch them score twice in the last 8 minutes to come from a goal down to beat Valencia 2-1 at home. But they're there again. They're joint top of the table with Real Madrid. And John can explain to us a little bit how they're doing it.
Yeah, just a really exciting team to watch. And I think the most surprising thing about them is that, you know, they made a huge amount of transfers in the summer. No one expected them to come out playing the sort of football they did, on the basis of the fact that they lost, you know, important players. But, you know,
Oriol Romeo, their top scorer.
Yeah, yeah.
In Tati Castellanos, their main defensive midfielder in Oriol Romeo, their best centre-back in Santi Bueno, all gone.
Yeah, absolutely. But what they've done is they've brought in a number of, almost rehabilitated a number of players from around Europe. So Daley Blint, everyone knows Daley Blint. But, you know, we thought that he was in his twilight era, gets let go by Bayern Munich, but ends up playing for Girona in this really flexible sort of left centre-back, turning into a left back position. Eric Garcia, again, a player that Spanish football fans will know, you know, questions about whether or not he was going to make it at the top level, and here he is doing it for Girona right now. And yeah, players across the pitch who, you know, maybe people didn't expect to turn things around the way they did. Alex Garcia, just absolutely bossing it as the pivot player for them. We've got Savio on loan from Troyes, who's just an incredible ball carrier, dribbler, creative player. Dovbyk up front, again, another player who was like tearing up in Ukraine, but like who thinks that's going to necessarily translate into being a really dangerous target man in La Liga. So just players across the field, fun to watch. The system overall, really good to watch as well. A really interesting clip doing the rounds on social media from Michel this weekend, where he was talking about how he's become a lot more pragmatic in terms of how he gets his teams to defend, saying in the past that he would have been too aggressive at making them press his teams press high and aggressively, but now he's realised that he has to protect the team as well. He has to think of ways of being able to allow them to press in those aggressive moments as well as drop into a more conservative situations as well. And obviously that resulting in a team. What we know about Michel is that he's brought teams up from the Segunda into the top division, and those teams have then dropped straight back down again. Whereas with what we're seeing with Girona is Michel actually learning how to negotiate that promotion situation and actually then kicking on from keeping Girona up last season into actually making them a really, really dangerous outfit this season. So yeah, whether or not they can stay at the top of the table, you're the expert on Spanish football, Phil, so I'll leave that one up to you, but it's definitely looking like they're going to be there and thereabouts when it comes to Champions League football, and I think that's a really exciting prospect for everyone to see them playing in Europe.
I think they've already secured Champions League football. I know it's only match day 15, but I think... And okay, all right, this maybe that's a bit of a wild thing to say, but I think
you've just done a Brighton when I said the title contenders.
Have I just done a Brighton? Maybe I've just done a Brighton. But they're 10 points clear, and everything that you've said, John, you know, I completely agree with. And they're 10 points clear of fifth. I think they've given themselves such a good chance. We've mentioned Barcelona. We've mentioned Girona. They both meet next Monday at 7 a.m. for OptiSport viewers. It's going to be a terrific, terrific game, so make sure you watch it. I'm telling everyone, always watch Girona. You got to watch them away to Barcelona. It's a local derby as well, so it should be a terrific game.
What do you make of that fixture, Phil? Because when Girona played against Real Madrid, it was a bit of a damp squib in the end. Everyone was excited about the possibilities, and I think they ended up losing 3-0 in that game. Do you think the same thing might happen here?
They did lose 3-0, but actually the opening sort of 20-30 minutes, they created a huge number of chances and things could have gone a little bit differently.
So it ended 3-0, Phil.
It did end 3-0, Bridgie, and you've got to stick your chances away and you've got to take them. But they created them at least, and that is obviously a very positive thing for Michel and his team. And when they... There are a few more games into it now. I think he's got them believing. He's now no longer talking about, okay, we just need to get enough points to make sure we don't avoid relegation. That's out the window. They're talking about starting to dream about doing something impressive here. And I think this is a really big game. They go into it without too much pressure.
Could we see them do a Leicester City and actually win this, Phil?
Listen, we've mentioned the L word on the podcast before. Everybody's talking about Leicester here in Spain. So, yeah, I mean... It's not beyond the realms of possibility. And if they did do a Leicester, it would be more than a Leicester, because I cannot stress enough what a small club Girona are. This is not a traditional footballing nation. This is city. This is only their fourth season in La Liga. They're not a traditional La Liga club. They do have the City group. And anyway, we have mentioned this previously on the pod, but to go up against the giants of Real Madrid and Barcelona and to still be here... Heading towards halfway through the season, they're level on points with Real Madrid. They've almost got they've got the exact same record as Real Madrid. They've scored more goals than Real Madrid, more than goals than anyone in La Liga. So they're just an incredible side. So, looking forward to seeing that game against Barcelona. Elsewhere in La Liga this weekend, Real Madrid beat Granada by 2-0. Jude Bellingham didn't score, so we're not going to talk about it at all. not really, but it wasn't actually a particularly exciting game. Not a huge amount happened, but Real Madrid got the win against a side who were considerably inferior to them.
Phil, we have to talk about the sock incident, please. Can you just give us a little bit of an explanation on that? Because I've got a story from my daughter and her Wall's End girls team about these socks. So, yeah, go on.
Okay. Wolves and Girls team and Real Madrid cutting holes in their socks.
Yes.
Okay. Brahim Diaz scored for Real Madrid against Granada, and he revealed that he's copying Jude Bellingham by cutting holes in his socks, so they're not that tight around the calves. And he scored this week. Jude Bellingham didn't score this week. Did your daughter score this weekend as well?
She didn't. But about 3 or 4 weeks ago, she was getting serious cramp in the calves, so I got her onto the side of the field, and I just got the scissors and just give the socks a little bit of a snip so that the tension wasn't on the calves, and put 3 holes in the back of the socks. And I was told by my daughter that I'm an absolute idiot. Why have you done that? I look so stupid. And a week later, I showed her Jude Bellingham, and everything is, it's the in thing to do now. Oh, it's fantastic. You're the best dad in the world for doing that. Yeah, well, there you go. It's amazing how it just takes one superstar to be doing it. But when a father does it, you're not seen as a superstar. So I'm just pleased that we had to highlight that because, I thought it was an interesting story.
It is, but obviously, maybe, I don't know if there are any sock manufacturers listening to us, you're doing something wrong, lads, because you've got all these players who've got, problems with their socks, so maybe you need to rethink things there. All right, enough sock chat. let's move on and talk about the draw for Euro 2024, which we had it live on Optus Sport. The tournament, of course, is going to be live on Optus Sport in June 2024, as well as the playoffs for the competition in March 2024, all live on Optus Sport, so you know where to go to see the biggest tournament of the summer, and the second biggest tournament as well. Copa America's on Optus Sport as well, so we've got the summer covered for football. The groups then, let's start with start with England, who are in Group C. They've got Serbia, Denmark and Slovenia on paper, John. This would look like how can I say this without being disrespectful? It's a group that England would expect to get out of.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, that when it comes to tournament football, momentum is so important. So I think if you have a comfortable group to sort of, even if you have to work your way through a couple of teething problems, this sort of group isn't going to present them any problems in terms of the qualification. So I think Southgate et al. Will be looking at this group and thinking, yeah, this is perfect. This is just what we need. Just get into our rhythm. Get out of the group and then start worrying about the knockout stages after that.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting group. I think that Denmark will be relishing the chance to get revenge over England from the, we robbed them at Wembley in the semi-final 2020, so they need no more incentive. And a strike of it, it'd be hoping that, I think it's, Alex, I'm a big fan of Mitrovic, Serbian striker. I think the manager just be hoping that he hasn't gone away, for the money, and he'll be underdone because of what he's missing out in the Premier League as opposed to playing the Saudi Arabian League. They've always got a chance. I think Slovenia make up the numbers in that group, but Serbia and Denmark, they're no pushovers, and you're saying that England should get out of this group. Yes, they should, but it's you're in the Euros, anything can happen. So I was when I saw the group draw, I was a little bit, I wasn't as excited as I thought I might have been. I was kind of going, oh, hang on a minute, this could be a little bit of a stuttery start. So we'll remain to be seen. I'm hoping that they can get through. But yeah, watch out for Denmark and Serbia. They're there for a reason.
Group C isn't the group of death. We're not entirely sure what is the group of death, because Group B is Spain, Croatia, Italy and Albania, which looks, pretty dangerous. And then Group D has Netherlands, France and Austria, and then the playoff winner from the A path. So that could be really dangerous as well.
Well, give us your take on Spain then. Come on then, because that is not an easy group.
It's not an easy group at all. They've got recent experience playing against Croatia and Italy, because they're the two sides that they beat in the final four of the Nations League this summer. So they beat Italy 2-1 with a late goal from Joselu, who scored a couple of minutes before the end. So that wasn't necessarily a particularly easy game. And then they beat Croatia on penalties. Mm-hmm. It finished 0-0. So they've got recent experience of playing these two teams, and neither of them was easy. The papers here have said they've Spain straight into group of death. So they're pretty sure that this is about as bad a draw as it could possibly have been. And they're quite sort of generally quite pessimistic anyway about the national team. This is not a country or a national press that necessarily gets behind the national team too much. And yeah, it's a really difficult draw for Spain. I would expect them to get through, because correct me if I'm wrong, but the third place teams also go through as well to the knockout stages. So you've got to do really, really badly, I think, to get eliminated from the group stages, right?
Yeah, we're expecting any Rodri post-match interviews where he talks about how they turned up to play football and yet, despite that, they lost, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Rodri's not backwards and coming forward when he says those kind of things. So, but actually, speaking of Rodri, he's possibly the most important player for Spain. He might be the best Spanish footballer around at the moment. And the figure of Rodri has just been growing and growing and growing. And now he's just number one in terms of the midfield, which is a pretty tasty midfield with Rodri, Pedri, and then it would have probably been Gavi. But because of his injury, he's going to be out. So there's a space up for grabs there. But yeah, Spain are contenders. They are maybe in the group just below, I would say, France, Portugal and maybe England. Are we agreed at those three?
I've just seen the France and Netherlands in that group with Austria, and then obviously the winners from the playoff. Potentially, it looks like it could be Wales. So I'm hoping it is going to be Wales. I want to see them in as well, but I just can't see anybody. And this is coming from an Englishman. You want to win. I can't see anybody touching France. They've got something. And if they can deliver and keep their off-the-field antics to one side and keep everything in-house, I can't see them being stopped after going through this. And when you look at the other groups as well, I was looking down at the Group E, Belgium. I think they've got a great chance of getting through that. You never know what they're going to do in major tournaments. They've always been the ones that have threatened with their superstars. They've never been able to deliver. They've had a lot of in-house shenanigans going on as well. And then you look at Group F, Portugal, Turkey, Czech Republic, and the winners of Group C. Portugal, they'll just go about their business as always. I think they're going to be in the mix as well. So it's going to be a very, very interesting European tournament. I can't wait to be part of it, Phil, and see what happens, because I'm an Englishman. I've said many times when I've been working with Optus Sport that it's coming home. It's never come home. The Lioness has brought it home. So I'm not going to get carried away with the England men's team, because there is some absolute powerhouses going up against each other in the latter groups of this tournament, and anybody's capable of winning it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Scotland fan. I follow Scotland internationally. So, a very different experience of following the international game. But I think a fun group for Scotland. It's nice to have the opening game of the tournament against Germany. That'll be a nice match to remember. And a tough group, really, for Scotland, with Switzerland and Hungary in there as well. You've already mentioned, Phil, that the best third-placed teams in groups are going to go through. And you kind of want, from that point of view, to have just a sitter of a team in there that you can say, well, you know, we'll get one good result in and then see what we can pick up elsewhere. And I'm not sure that Switzerland, I guess, are the other team in this group, and they're going to be a tough prospect as well. So this is what you play for, I guess, when you're going through the qualification round.
You must be delighted at what Clark and John Carver have done and achieved with Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think a lot of the credit has to go down to the new league system that they've put in place with the Nations League, because it just allows teams that usually aren't as competitive to play in competitive fixtures on the run up to these tournaments, and that's part of the reason why Scotland are looking so good right now. And this is what you go through the qualifications for. You want to challenge yourself in this kind of group. So from that point of view, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
So who wins it, boys?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? It's very difficult to look past France for me, just because of the sheer talent. But then I go sort of man for man through the Portugal squad, and I think that's an insanely talented squad as well. And I've no longer got any faith that England can win, because they've come so close and they haven't been able to do it. So I'm almost discounting them, almost, even though they really should have had a international trophy with this incredible group. So who wins it? I'll say France.
Yeah.
But you know, without too much conviction.
You know, England are going to have to win at some point. I mean, with this crop of players, they can't keep finding increasingly creative ways of not winning international tournaments. So as a Scotland fan, it brings me no joy to say that I'm fully expecting England to I'm not going to say bring it home. I can't bring myself to say those words, but I think this could be it. This could be the
I'm
one.
Very close to the border where I live, John, and I will never be saying Scotland are going to be bringing it home, because I don't want them to get anywhere near. I've said I'm delighted that they qualified, mate. I'm hoping they get smashed every single game, don't get me wrong, and I'm hoping that my heart's telling me England, but I'm going to say France or Portugal will get the job done in the Euros.
But John, from an analytical perspective, which team would you expect to have? Which team do you think has the best sort of 11 and the best group to go and lift the trophy?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because international football is such a different beast to the domestic game, and so much of it comes down to what, as I said already, like momentum, getting the players in the best sort of state of mind, but also in a system which broadly works without a huge amount of time to train that system. So France have been doing it for a long time now. They've got the they've got both the wherewithal to be able to win these kind of tournaments, but also the experience of having done that. And when you have players like Kylian Mbappe, who is just a clutch player, as we saw in the World Cup final, despite the fact that didn't end up going their way, they're just such a dangerous prospect to face. And I think England, I mean pound for pound, the England squad is incredible now. And maybe familiarity makes us a little bit sort of numb to how good it is. But when you consider the possibilities of like the midfield combinations that they have, the you know, Harry Kane, the best nine in the world right now for me, absolutely tearing up in Germany. He'll be well placed to absolutely tear up that tournament for those reasons, and then just a litany of players around them that are always going to be difference makers. I think
John, it sounds like you're saying it's coming home. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I genuinely think that this England squad has never been better, and they've come close on a couple of occasions. It's inevitable that they're going to win something at some point. So yeah, if they can beat France, they can beat France. They nearly did that in the World Cup. Could have gone either way that game, and that's tournament football. You know, at the end of the day, these things just sort of topple one way or the other, and there's going to be a point, even by the law of large numbers, that England are going to get there and get this thing done.
You heard it, Bridgie. He said it's coming home.
I did, mate.
He said it's coming home.
I'm smiling. I'm very excited. And that's coming from a man that's in touch with his Scottish borders. I'm just absolutely buzzing with that. And John's just lost a lot of followers from Scotland.
That was the analyst's way of saying it's coming home, basically.
Yeah. Can we change my name for this episode? Can I go under an anonymous name?
Brilliant.
Okay. I follow Greece in terms of international football, and we're in the playoffs. We've got to come through against Kazakhstan. Hopefully we beat Kazakhstan and then Georgia or Luxembourg, and then straight into a diplomatically interesting group alongside Turkey and Portugal and Czechia as well. So hopefully Greece make it through. I know we've got a big Greek community in Australia as well,
yes,
so that'd be good for everyone.
And Greece already brought it home once before, so, you know.
Yeah.
They did, in magnificent fashion, in 2004. Shall we could do a whole podcast of that if you want, John.
I was at Hull City on a pre-season base camp, altitude training, Bormio in Italy. And we watched every single game because we had Stelios Giannakopoulos involved with the Greek national team, and it was fantastic to see him do so well. And we had when we got back to Hull with Phil Brown. Bolton Wanderers, one of them out. When we got back to Bolton Wanderers, Sam Allardyce and Phil Brown, it was fantastic. We put on this Greek themed dinner and lunch for Stelios' arrival with his medal, and he came in, and it was just brilliant because everybody loves Sam Allardyce, whereas Phil Brown, it was a bit, you know, he was the show pony. The lads were a little bit thinking, oh, what's he going to do? And it was great to see him stand up on the table with two plates and smash them together to celebrate Stelios' arrival. And he cut all his hands open. Stelios said, "We have special plates for that, boss." So tremendous.
We do have special plates. Yes. So don't try that at home, kids. Yeah. Don't try that at home. But yeah, there we go. Listen, we're just about running out of time on today's Optus Sport football podcast. A big thank you to Bridgie and John McKenzie for joining us this week. Adios, guys.
Adios. Can I just leave you one more little carrot, please? I've forgot to mention something.
Yes.
Pep Guardiola against Ange Postecoglou match. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to leave one out there with you, right, and for everybody to have a think about and get it on socials. Ange Postecoglou is part of the City Group, obviously with the Marinos, and obviously he went to Celtic then, but the City Group have seen what he's all about. I reckon that this Premier League season, they're monitoring him, and that result will concrete the move when Pep Guardiola decides a time is enough at Manchester City. Postecoglou will be the Manchester City manager. There you go.
Wow. Big call.
Just remember that. Bridgie. Remember this one for a year time or 2 years time, all right?
Okay. Next time you've got something like that to say, don't say it at the end of the podcast.
Well, it's good to get it out at the end because now people will be going, oh, socials, let's get straight on it.
All right. Remember what Bridgie said then. thanks very much, guys, and look forward to doing another podcast soon. A reminder that every game of the Premier League and La Liga is live only on Optus Sport, and we have a midweek round of Premier League this week. Villa hosting City, United playing Chelsea, Spurs and West Ham going head-to-head. We've got DFP Pokal 2, and this weekend it's stacked with the Premier League, La Liga, WSL WSL. All the details on the Optus Sports app. Thanks for your company on the Optus Sport Football Podcast, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.